Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
It is 5 minutes past the hour. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Currently, a lot of attention on the issue of hiring a new generation of veterans from the past, now more than a decade, of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. Military services are focused on doing a better job of helping service members successfully transition out of uniform service and into the civilian workforce. We've heard a lot about some of the common challenges, including the fact that employers don't always know how to interpret military skills into the kinds of talents they need in their workforce, and that service members don't always know how to explain those skills. On this week's show, we're going to talk about some of the specific barriers to civilian employment for recently separated service members. They were identified as part of a new campaign that's being led by the Army's Warrior Transition Command. The command partnered with the nation's largest human resources organization, the Society for Human Resource Management. SHRM surveyed employers across the country to identify myths, misconceptions, and other factors that can keep companies from hiring veterans, even though they say they want to. My guest for most of the hour is Nancy Hammer. She's a senior government affairs policy counsel at SHRM. She's worked closely on this issue. We start our discussion talking about the origins of the partnership with the Army.
You know, we kind of dipped our toe in the water of this issue, and very soon you start meeting all the other folks who are working on it. And we found that it made sense for us to work together on this particular distribution of information, particularly about post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury in the workplace. But it's something that SHRM has had a focus on for the past several years, and I think there's just a recognition that when we have so many troops coming back and needing to transition into the workforce, that HR professionals play a key role in that. So over the past few years, our state councils and a lot of our chapters have been working at the local level and been doing some really nice things in their communities to try to link up employers and veterans, working with veteran service organizations. So there was always a lot going on at SHRM, and there's a lot going on with the various services and other federal agencies. So wherever it makes sense, we want to work together to really maximize the goals and the results that we can get from these initiatives.
And you mentioned distribution of information to employers. Was this information sort of already out there and well-developed, or is this kind of a body of research, for lack of a better word, that's still a work in progress?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, in some ways, I think we suffer, as I'm sure you know, from information overload. So when we are trying to communicate things to our 260,000 members, we want to make sure that we give it to them in multiple ways and at multiple times. So maybe they're not particularly focused on an issue the first time they run across an article or some information. So I always feel like more is better. And I think that because the media and the news stories placed a lot of focus on the idea of post-traumatic stress, and linking that concept with returning veterans, there was really a need to maybe correct some of the misperceptions that the general public may have, including employers, that this is something that's unique to this population, when in fact it's probably something they've dealt with in their workplaces before and just may not have actually realized it.
Mm-hmm. But before we get into those misperceptions, which, like I said, we'll spend most of the time on, I think, Jeff Pond from your organization, when this initiative was rolled out at a press conference earlier this month, described, you know, I think repeatedly that this is really an urgent issue from SHRM's perspective and from the perspective of the professional HR community. Can you talk a little bit about why it's seen as urgent?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when we look at all of the issues that HR professionals need to know about, there's a lot of them. You know, they have to be experts on benefits, on, you know, onboarding new employees, on benefit packages. But all of those things are ongoing. You know, right now in this country, we really need to focus on our attention on these returning veterans, in part because the whole country is now focused on it. So we can't sort of delay in maximizing that sort of national positive public attention on what's happening. So we don't want to lose another generation of veterans, and that's why we've really encouraged our members to get involved at the local level and also looked at ways that we can make sure to provide them information and suggestions and effective practices from the federal level so that they can increase their hiring of veterans and have a better transition for these folks into the workplace.
And we'll talk more about exactly how you're distributing that information, but let's get into some of the survey results that you found for this campaign. And I guess let's start with the good news, which you guys discovered that there is a general willingness and eagerness out there in the private sector employment community to hire veterans. Can you tell me about what you found there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we surveyed a couple different times in 2010 and then again in 2012. And this most recent survey, we found that two-thirds of employers who were surveyed said that they had hired veterans within the past 36 months. And that's a significant jump from 2010, when just over half of organizations said they had done so. So I think that is good news. And what we wanted to see was that kind of a change, because what we had always seen was a general positive impression of what it means to have a veteran in the workplace. Employers have long recognized the value and unique skill set that veterans learn in the military, and they're things that don't always come with an applicant to a job, and they're skills like leadership, sense of responsibility, the ability to work under pressure, teamwork, all those kinds of skills that aren't necessarily taught in school and aren't necessarily in the possession of everybody who's going to submit a resume. So what it was heartening to me in this most recent survey is that now what has always been there, which was this positive outlook, it's now starting to move the needle on the actual hiring, and I think that's very encouraging.
So a positive change there between the two surveys. Do you know what to attribute that to? I mean, do you want to take credit for it at SHRM there, or is it more the change of public sensibility?
Well, I think it's a combination. I mean, I sure hope that the education and the information we've put out there has made a difference. You know, I know we might talk more about this later, but one of the things that employers have always said to us, our members have said, is we don't know where to find veterans. So we really tried to focus a lot of our outreach on that and putting together a human resources toolkit and listing all the different places they could go. And it's not just our members who recognize that they don't know where to go. We were approached by a lot of the federal agencies that had created job sites, and they were frustrated because HR professionals and employers didn't know about their particular job sites. So, again, sometimes I think it's almost the crush of information that people get overwhelmed. So we try to simplify it a little bit and say, here are the five or six best places to go, and here's 20 others that you can go, you know, once you've been to the others. So I think that it is a combination. I think it's the constant reminders in the public square and the discourse in America right now about the importance of making sure that we do our best for these veterans who have fought on our behalf and served on our behalf, and that we do what we can to make special efforts to ease their transition back. And it's not going to be just because it's the right thing to do or the feel-good thing to do, that these folks also are going to bring tremendous value to your workplace. So I think it's that and employers learning some specific places to go and things to do, that those things combined have moved the needle.
That's a good transition into our discussion about the barriers you identified there at SHRM, the first of which is that issue of just connecting employers with veterans. And that's something that I've heard over and over again from both the government side and the private employer side. What from your perspective specifically has been, can be done to improve that? Because it seems like some of the onus has got to be on the individual service member or former service member, right, to make themselves available, to make themselves visible, to make their skills understandable to an employer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, the top two reasons, as you mentioned, the first is not knowing where to go. And the one that follows closely after that as an identified obstacle from employers is not being able to translate the skills, the military skills, to the civilian skills and workplace. And I think there's a lot of work still to be done in this area. We can't expect civilian employers to learn all of this jargon and figure these things out. There has to be a coming together on both sides, both the job seeker and, frankly, I think some of the government agencies who serve the veterans should do a better job of getting the information to them that they need at the right time. So, you know, keeping them as people that they are responsible for after they've left the service, but helping them with that transition. So I think that we could do a better job on both ends and somehow meet in the middle. But I agree that I think there has to be an education on the part on the military side to say, okay, how can we help you before you leave us have a resume that's going to make sense to people outside of the military?
Are you seeing that in the military side? I mean, my sense is that the military services care about this issue and they want to improve their abilities to do that, to transition people out. But have you seen progress?
I think so. I mean, there are lots of translators out there as sort of the first step to that. I think we are moving toward getting beyond that as well. As you said, this is something that comes up, I think, in every meeting and is recognized by everybody. It's just figuring out how do you structurally implement this. And I think we're getting there because what I'm seeing on the part of employers, at least, which is the side I know best, is they are feeling more empowered to ask questions. You know, I think in the past we've always been very, very careful to not ask somebody if they're a veteran because you don't want to appear to be discriminating. Private employers don't have the same leeway that, you know, a federal government employer that might have, you know, affirmative rules about hiring veterans. They don't have the same leeway, I think, to ask those questions because they're very, very focused solely on does the person before me have the skills to do the job. But I think because of the national conversation, we're feeling more empowered to ask people to voluntarily disclose if they have a veteran status, and that opens up a whole nother line of questions that will elicit the kind of information that the employer needs. Rather than just, you know, stopping if they get an answer they don't understand, they might say, well, what exactly does that, you know, military code mean and how would that apply to this job? And inviting those kinds of answers that would help them make a decision.
Nancy Hammer is a senior government affairs policy counsel at the Society for Human Resource Management, talking about their partnership with the Army Warrior Transition Command, identifying myths to getting civilian employment for recently separated service members. We'll continue our discussion after a short break. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to another edition of On DOD. Focusing this week on a new campaign led by the Army's Warrior Transition Command. The objective is to get past some of the most common myths, misconceptions, and other kinds of barriers that keep service members from successfully transitioning out of uniform and into the civilian workplace. The campaign's a partnership with Society for Human Resource Management. They conducted a wide-ranging survey of the nation's employers to try to identify what some of those most common myths are. They're using the results to help form an educational campaign to help HR professionals across the country more successfully integrate a new generation of veterans into their workforces. My guest this week is Nancy Hammer. She's a senior government affairs policy counsel at SHRM, and she has been working closely on this issue. She says SHRM surveys did indeed identify some of those misconceptions, but they also produced some good news.
You know, in surveys, you don't usually get responses in the 90s. But when we asked our members to name, you know, how would rate specific qualities that a veteran brings to the workplace, their answers were all extremely high. And so there are things like, you know, do you think that veterans will be good at teamwork? Will they be good at handling stress? Will they be good leaders? The responses are all extremely high. And I can't overemphasize, or I can't emphasize enough how important those types of skills are to employers, because you don't always get those. You may have someone who has the technical expertise you need, but they can't work with other people. They can't lead a project. They can't handle setbacks in a project. And those are the kinds of qualities that employers really value. And they recognize that the military trains people in those skills. And so that is something that I think employers have always looked for and been very attracted to. Now, there is, I think, also a need for employers to focus not only on that hiring, but also on the retention, because sometimes I think that they don't, they want to make sure that the cultural transition is also a successful one and that they don't have high turnover if the veteran employee doesn't find people within the organization who, you know, understand their perspective.
Yeah, do we have data on that? Do we know what turnover rates have been like so far for this generation of wounded warriors?
I don't have turnover rates, and we didn't ask that question specifically in our survey, but it's been more of an anecdotal understanding that people will sometimes there can be a higher turnover rate or just sort of a mismatch of expectations. But again, I think that goes really on the employer to create a solid onboarding process. And there's been a lot of very positive, effective practices coming out as far as having affinity groups where veterans within an organization may be able to get together and make recommendations to management about things they'd like to see changed, or just to have that camaraderie of a shared experience. And a lot of employers now have those types of affinity groups for all different kinds of employees and have found them to be a positive way to manage their workplace. And there's also mentorship. So having, if you know someone who has a military background in your workforce, pairing them with a new veteran employee so that they have somebody that they can go to with their questions that they may not feel comfortable asking the employer themselves.
Let's get back into some of the challenges that your survey identified. I think there were three main ones, one of which was also around post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury, and the idea of reasonable accommodations that I understand employers told you was a challenge when it came to hiring veterans. What does that mean, they find it a challenge? They don't know what to expect from these employees. They don't know what they need to do. What is the specific challenge?
Yeah, I think what that question really reflected, and it was 46% of the survey respondents said that PTSD and other mental health issues were a challenge when hiring veterans. To me, that really indicates a knowledge gap. I mean, they're basically saying, we've heard a lot about this, but we don't really know. So they sort of say it's a challenge for us. Because when you look further down, 83% also say it's worth it to accommodate these conditions in the workplace. So I think it's a matter of demystifying the conditions, helping employers to understand that not every veteran suffers from PTSD, and that also it may not be something that is disruptive to the work environment. And if it is, there are some very simple accommodations that can be done. So I think it's really an education effort. The other thing I think is interesting, that because we've focused so much on connecting this concept with veterans, is we lose sight of the fact that it exists in other populations as well. So people who have experienced something traumatic, whether it's a car accident or something else, may also suffer from some of these symptoms.
Yeah.
And that they're on a continuum. You know, it's not the same experience for everybody.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a quick clip that I want to play for our listeners. This is part of an informational video that Army Warrior Transition Command put together, probably with Shurum's help. I'm not sure who all the collaborators were. But to the point you were just making, this is Dr. Ferris Tuma, the chief of the Traumatic Stress Research Program at the National Institute of Mental Health, talking about that exact issue about perceptions of post-traumatic stress.
It may be surprising for people to understand that in the United States, motor vehicle accidents are actually one of the leading causes of PTSD. In the same way that we wouldn't expect a survivor of a motor vehicle accident who develops PTSD to go on a driving rampage, in no way should we expect a returning service member or veteran to act out violently their emotions in a workplace or in any other context.
And Nancy, that gets to what you were just saying. Even in situations where post-traumatic stress does indeed exist in the case of a specific veteran, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a huge workplace challenge.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other reality that is that, you know, when we get this sort of response to our survey, I think it reflects a larger lack of information about mental health issues generally. So, you know, there is a lot more going on in this area. We're going to have a lot more people with different conditions in the workplace, including autism. So it's something that I think as a society we're becoming more educated about, and employers are part of that education process. The good news is HR professionals have long now worked with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that's a strange concept to them. They get it. They just may have more experience with physical injuries than mental health injuries, but it's something that's easily translatable, and I think the education campaigns will really help with that. And frankly, you know, what you find, and I'm sure this comes as no surprise, the minute you have somebody and you hire somebody and you realize that they may be working with a certain condition, it takes all the mystery out of it. You're like, oh, okay, I know this person, and they work fine, and they have post-traumatic stress, and it's all fine. It's just the unknown that people end up being concerned about. And once they have experience and knowledge, those concerns can be easily dealt with.
My guest on this week's edition of On DoD is Nancy Hammer, a senior government affairs policy counsel at the Society for Human Resource Management. They're partnering with the Army on a new campaign to educate civilian employers on hiring military veterans. When we come back, we'll look more closely at one of the three main myths SHRM identified in its survey of employers. That surrounds the idea of having to make reasonable accommodations for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll come back and talk more with Nancy after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servin. The Army this month launched a new campaign designed to try and overcome a challenge across the military, helping a new generation of military veterans transition out of uniform service and into the civilian workforce. It's a partnership with the Society for Human Resource Management, which is helping the Army communicate with employers about some of the misconceptions and other barriers to hiring veterans. We'll post a link to some of the educational materials at federalnewsradio.com. The campaign sprung from research conducted by SHRM, a nationwide survey of HR professionals about the challenges involved in bringing veterans on board at their companies. Nancy Hammer works on the issue for SHRM. She's my guest for most of the hour. In this segment, we'll focus more on one of those barriers. Employers identified PTSD and traumatic brain injury as a challenge, especially when it comes to making reasonable accommodations for employees with those conditions. Yeah, it's a great point about the ADA. Can you talk a little bit more about what employers have learned since, I guess, the early 90s when it was originally passed, how that maps to mental health? And what does it mean, assuming mental health is covered under the ADA, because I don't know that, but what does it mean to provide accommodations, reasonable accommodations, that is, for someone with post-traumatic stress?
You know, the Americans with Disabilities Act is going to cover any disability, whether it's, you know, mental related or physical related, whatever it is. Even, you know, internal systems of your body functioning can be considered disabilities. And it really comes into play if your condition makes it difficult for you to do your job. And if an employer can provide some kind of an accommodation to help you do your job, then they are legally bound to do so, so long as it's not, you know, some outrageous cost. What's great is that typically the most common accommodations for post-traumatic stress tend to be very simple. So one of the places, or the main place that we recommend for our members to go is something called the Job Accommodation Network. And that is provided by the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Disability and Employment Policy. SHRM has long worked with ODEP as one of their alliance partners, again, to try to get the word out about disabilities in general in the workplace. And JAN, the Job Accommodation Network, has a, consultants that will talk to employers. It's all confidential, and they'll provide advice on how to accommodate different disabilities and give a sense of what the costs might be. So when I just looked up at their website, and the most common ones, you know, were nothing complex. Managing stress, that an individual with PTSD may benefit from a flexible work schedule, which is something that SHRM has really been focused on for all employees. They may make sure your leave policies are up to date, being allowed to work from home, that kind of thing. They also talk about maintaining concentration, reducing audible or visible distractions near the person's work area. So these are relatively simple things that an employer can work with that individual employee to figure out what's going to make it easier for them to work. And, you know, it's funny because accommodations often aren't a big deal. And I think sometimes when people have an accommodation, they don't even realize it. So I have a special desk chair that where I can move the seat to make it more comfortable for me to sit. That's an accommodation. So it doesn't have to be something complex. It's just whatever can be done to assist a person to do their jobs. And what's great is employers have a great resource in JAN, the Job Accommodation Network, and there's a lot of good information on the internet. So what it really takes is the employee to feel comfortable to approach the HR department and say, look, I could really use some help in reducing distractions or whatever it might be to help me do my job better.
That was my next question. Are these things that generally that employees themselves need to request?
Right. So, you know, part of what the Americans with Disabilities Act says is that an employer really has no business in asking you questions about conditions you may have unless it's related to the job. So it is important for an employee to come forward and say, hey, look, I'm having trouble concentrating. I am having difficulty with stress, or I need time off to do medical appointments, whatever it might be, to have that open dialogue with your employer. And I think as these stigmas are reducing, I know it can be difficult, you know, to reveal something that you're having trouble with, but what's encouraging is I think employers' understanding is increasing. They're dealing with things with other employees that you're probably not even aware of. You know, you're not the only person who is seeking assistance from the employer. And third, you know, federal law requires that employers work with folks who have a disability who need an accommodation in the workplace.
As an accommodation for PTS, you mentioned that one of the most commonly requested and granted is flexible work schedules, teleworking also. That is something that I know a lot of employees, certainly in federal agencies and probably in the private sector too, would like to have, but thus far have not been granted the ability to do by their managers. I wonder, as an HR manager, if you end up granting those sort of flexibilities to people with PTS and TBI and not to the remainder of your workforce, do you risk creating a world of, you know, haves and have-nots and create kind of two separate classes of employees?
Well, all accommodations are, you know, unique to the employee who needs them. So if that is something that that particular employee needs, it shouldn't be something that, you know, the employer needs to be able to manage whatever the perception is. And frankly, that is where I think the privacy element of it is important, that, you know, other employees need to realize that the employer deals with them all as individuals. But I think more important than that is that this is an issue that SHRM is really looking at holistically, not just for veterans in the workplace or people with disabilities or people with families. We are really promoting workplace flexibility as a win-win for employers. There's a lot of employers that provide it to all of their employees that have actually found that their returns on their investment have gone up. They've had greater productivity despite everyone's concerns. So we're trying to teach employers and HR how to do that right. And again, I think that's something that as our roads become more congested and lives become more complicated is going to become a real necessity in the workplace anyway.
Mm-hmm. In just the few minutes we have left here, I want to talk about some of the outreach that SHRM is doing, armed with all this information that you now have about how to break down some of the barriers between employers and actually successfully hiring veterans. What are you doing to communicate this information?
Well, you know, SHRM has a lot of, we have about 6 conferences a year for our members, and we've tried to include educational sessions on hiring veterans, post-traumatic stress, and other related issues in all of our conferences. Our biggest one is our annual conference, which last year in Atlanta had 15,000 HR professionals. And we, at that conference, held a standalone day-long session about hiring veterans, everything from where do you find them. And I should clarify, too, and I feel bad because I spent this entire interview using the word veterans, we include National Guard and reservists mm-hmm. in that term mm-hmm. because these folks are, you know, doing the same kind of work. They may need the same kind of assistance in the workplace, and they bring the same sorts of valuable skills. So I want to clarify that when I say veterans, we're really talking about veterans, National Guard, and reservists.
And by that, you mean people who are currently serving in the National Guard or reserves?
Correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Or maybe transitioning out of it as well.
Sure.
But SHRM has an annual conference, which last year was in Atlanta with 15,000 HR professionals in attendance. And we held a standalone day-long session about how to hire veterans and how to support veterans, guard, and reservists that you may have in your workplace. So it really covers soup to nuts, from hiring to retention to supporting these folks, and even about what you can do, simple workplace things you can do to be supportive of their families when they're called up. So we've really tried to make sure that we get these educational information out there. We also created a toolkit specifically for HR professionals. And it starts with the assumption that they don't have anything in their workplace. And it also starts with the assumption that the leadership may not be aware of the concept of doing something specifically for military-connected employees. So it tells the HR professional, how do you talk to the CEO and the COO and others in the C-suite about why this is important in your workplace? So we're doing that kind of thing and creating a special page on our website to collect all the information that we think would be helpful for our members to know.
Even if the HR professionals are on board, how well have these ideas penetrated into the C-suite?
Well, you know, again, I think this is where you can often see a disparity between very large employers who may have the ability to hire someone to manage a project specifically focused on military-connected employees or hiring veterans, versus some smaller organizations that may not have the ability to dedicate a person to the issue. But I think, again, it's the national dialogue that's making a difference, and we want to make sure that HR professionals can make the case that it's a smart, strategic business decision to have people with a military background in your workforce.
Nancy Hammer is a senior government affairs policy counsel at the Society for Human Resource Management. She's been working with the Army's Warrior Transition Command on their new campaign to educate employers about some of the barriers, myths, misconceptions that surround hiring a new generation of veterans. I mentioned earlier in the program that this new campaign was launched at the National Press Club in a press conference earlier this month. When we come back for our final segment on this week's show, we'll hear briefly from Brigadier General David Bishop speaking at that press conference. He is the commander of Warrior Transition Command. He explains the campaign from the Army side of the equation. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for joining us for another edition of On DOD. Talking this week about a new campaign led by the U.S. Army called Hire a Veteran. It's led by the U.S. Army's Warrior Transition Command. We've been talking most of the hour with Nancy Hammer from the Society for Human Resource Management. They've been partnering with the Army to build this campaign, which tries to identify some of the common myths, misperceptions, and other barriers that keep private employers from hiring a new generation of veterans. This campaign, as I said earlier, was rolled out earlier this month at the National Press Club in a press conference there. We're going to hear in our final segment from Brigadier General David Bishop, who spoke at that press conference. He's the commander of Warrior Transition Command. In this excerpt, he talks about the campaign from the Army's point of view, along with a little background on what it is that Warrior Transition Command does on a day-to-day basis.
Currently, we provide support and programs for over 10,000 active duty Guard and Reserve soldiers who are located at 29 warrior transition units and 9 community-based warrior transition units around the country and in Germany and Puerto Rico. These soldiers require more than 6 months of complex medical care, and 87% of them have served in combat. Their sole mission is to heal and transition back to their units or to civilian life. Throughout their recovery, each wounded, ill, and injured soldier works with an interdisciplinary team. That team can include a licensed clinical social worker, a nurse case manager, a physical therapist, an ombudsman, an occupational therapist, a human resources representative, a transition coordinator, and a personal advocate for our most seriously wounded soldiers. Supplemental specialists are brought in based on the unique needs of each and every soldier. In addition to focusing on the soldier's medical care, this team works with the soldier to create a personalized, comprehensive transition plan. This personalized roadmap focuses on the overall well-being of our recovering soldiers by focusing on 6 areas: career, physical, emotional, social, family, and spiritual. And it's based on developing personal goals, both short-term and long-term, that the soldier drives. We offer our wounded, ill, and injured soldiers a variety of resources to help them refocus on their career. What can they do? What do they want to do? And what needs to be done to get them to where they want to go? But also, we've had great success with providing internship opportunities for wounded warriors in the federal government under a program we call Operation Warfighter. We also provide access to education and certification programs, as well as access to ACAP, which is the Army Career and Alumni Program, which provides help with resume development, interview skills, and job assistance workshops. While the Army wants to retain as many of our well-trained soldiers as possible, the extent of their injuries often prevents that from happening. Many who we care for are unable to meet Army duty requirements due to their medical disabilities and the rigorous demands of military service. While they may not be able to perform their Army missions, we know they still have a lot to offer other employers. For example, leadership experience, ranging from a tank crew of 3 soldiers or a squad of 10 soldiers to a 5,000-person brigade. And we have soldiers that have those types of leadership experiences. They'll be looking for jobs in the near future. Negotiation skills that have been gained in places like the Balkans, Afghanistan, and Iraq, dealing with local community leaders, business leaders, and members of non-governmental organizations. Determination and perspective that has been gained over, in some cases, 2 to 5 years of overcoming physical disabilities and wounds from injuries that they sustained in their duties. And, of course, commitment to mission. Every soldier is focused on accomplishing their mission. They're trained to research, plan, execute, and evaluate each action to ensure that it contributes to a successful outcome. And that's what every soldier brings to the table. As someone who's led soldiers for nearly 30 years, what always stands out to me is trust. I can trust a soldier to get the job done. And typically under unimaginable pressure and aggressive timelines. Often they must assess the situation themselves and make critical judgments on their own and take initiative under tremendous pressure when no one is looking. It's this trust that enables our Army to accomplish so many difficult missions around the world for our country. Yet these valuable employees in many cases are struggling to find the opportunity for employment after they return home. Not only does this impact their long-term success financially, it can also impact their self-esteem and their long-term recovery. And it impacts the economy as well, and that's why it's such a top priority for the White House and our nation. Through experience, research, and conversations with corporate and government leaders, we've realized that we need to help prepare employers and HR professionals and ensure that their concerns aren't a deterrent to employing these great veterans. This campaign is about setting the conditions, not just preparing our soldiers for a new career as a veteran, but also preparing employers about this unique population that has so much to offer to their bottom line. To that end, we've created this Hire a Veteran Education campaign. Our goal for this campaign is for employers to gain clarity on how well military skills translate to civilian employment, PTSD and TBI, and reasonable accommodations, which will result in the employment of more wounded warriors. We also want to drive home the fact that reasonable accommodations for wounded warriors entering into the workplace are not difficult, inordinately expensive, or a burden, especially when compared to the value that these great Americans bring to each organization. In order to reach human resource professionals, employers, we've created a 10-minute video that addresses these top three misperceptions, as well as an online employee toolkit that you can find at our website at www.wtc.army.mil.
That is Brigadier General David Bishop. He is the commander of Warrior Transition Command, and we will post links to those resources that he just mentioned at federalnewsradio.com. Glad you could join us this afternoon for another edition of On DoD. If you missed any of the program today, most of which we spent with Nancy Hammer with the Society for Human Resource Management about the new Army Warrior Transition Command and SHRM campaign to boost employer awareness about what they need to do to successfully transition wounded warriors into their workforces, we'll post it all at federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for joining us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.